All right, we're in Link World RX Lamp. Bart, how are you?
Very good, Charles. How about you?
Doing well, man. So we've had a series of conversations about Link and RX and et cetera, et cetera. And now you're going to talk to us today about the core of Link that you call MinLink.
Exactly.
What does that mean?
Yep. Well, very good question. It's something I did last year before I actually got onto this team. So I moved here in January. And so I was actually blogging about the typical things that people blog about when introducing RX, which is duality and all of the, you know, fancy stuff.
Yeah.
And people were saying, like, I don't quite get it that, you know, those two things are duals. Like, are enumerable, are observable? Uh-huh. And so I said, let's approach it from a different angle, because you're always, you know, talking about those interfaces and, like, there's quite some noise in the interfaces.
Yeah.
So I wanted to minimize Link in terms of its type signatures. And I combined that with a long-standing thing that I wanted to do, which is combining that with minimizing Link on the operator level as well. Like today, if you dial them to enumerable or queryable, you get like 50 operators or so. And that's just a huge number. So people ask, what are the essential ones? Can we extract other ones on top of a base foundation of operators? And it turns out you can, like, you know, no surprise, it's like, again, you know, let's use the word monad here.
Okay.
Like, if you have bind and select many in Link, you can do a lot of things using that primitive alone. I will actually show that you can do a select and a where using that primitive, for example. And so the name, you know, at that point, Windows 7 was hot, it still is hot, of course, and, you know, all the architectural things. At that point, people were talking about MinLink, so I said, like, let's call it MinLink, you know, which is, like, you know, the core, if you will, of Link in general.
Interesting.
So question is, which operators do you need to implement in order to have full Link support? And then, you know, other things can be derived on top of those base primitives, which is like architectural layering, right? It's like having a pyramid upside down, like low-level thing here with just three or four operators, and then sort of build layers of abstraction on top of that. And, you know, all the way to the top, you could have, like, business intelligence operators over streams, which is like the stream inside thing, which is very specialized operators.
Yeah.
At the core, you can sort of reduce that to its very essence. And so it's that kind of layering that I want to do.
Great. Well, let's take a look at this.
Yes,
in some sense. So, you know, MinWin is you know, getting Windows to run, or actually the minimum set of Windows you need to boot.
Exactly.
So get rid of all of the extra layers, and you get a kernel, or what some call the kernel, and a little bit of the shell. But anyway, beyond that, I understand what you're saying. So this is the essentially the fundamental, you know, if you will, the monad inside of the machine.
It's like, you know, if you say about, you know, Windows NT and MinWin, people say it's Kotlin's NT, right? You know, it's the core of the core, you know, what Dave Kotlin envisioned as being Windows NT a long time ago. And sort of going back to that core foundation and then layer things on top of that cleanly. I would say MinLink is like, you know, Wadler's Link. Philip Wadler, the guy who did, you know, brought monads to functional programming and has done a lot of things about that. It's sort of that, you know, sort of see the forest for the trees, like that's the core, and then build on top of that other operators.
Excellent.
So it's like extracting and distilling the essence.
Perfect. Well, let's look at the essence of Link.
Okay.
Bart DeSmet.
Let's do it.
I like this, man.
Yep.
All right, rock and roll.
Okay. So, maybe we should start by, I will just start by drawing the diagram that I just sort of mentioned here, which is the architectural layering kind of thing, right? Whenever you talk about some clean architectural layering, I would say you want to have this pyramid upside down, where you have, in this particular part of the diagram, you have the base operators, base functionality, things you can't live without.
Sure.
And then on top of that, you want to build, you know, higher layers of abstraction. Let's actually put something on the stack here. I want to talk a little bit about beautiful mathematical principles to design APIs as well, which sort of falls out of this whole thing. So let me actually put this aside, and we'll sit down in a couple of minutes and talk about that for a second as well.
Good.
But so that's the diagram I sort of want to get, and then the idea is the level of specialization based on those operators is like, you know, things at the top are very specialized, but also have a narrow field, if you will, right? Like, if you sort of draw another pyramid in the other direction here, like, those operators at the bottom have a very broad applicability. You can use them for a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It might not be pretty to do so. It's like, you know, saying I have a language and I only need jumps, conditional jumps, in order to be able to do any kind of control flow. Mm-hmm. Yet that's a very general principle. You can do a lot of things with it. Mm-hmm. It will be annoying that you have to write go-tos everywhere. Some famous scientist actually said, like, don't do go-tos. Well, that's kind of the thing you're in. Like, with Link, you could say, you could do anything using select many and not have a where and a select, for example. Mm-hmm. Well, people will say, no, I don't quite like that. So you want to go higher up as well, but then at the top of this thing, you have such narrow operators that do something very specialized that it's hard to use them for other things. So it's like an interesting balance here. But it's more looking at the black part, you know, sort of distilling the essence at this side.
Okay.
So that's actually... draw the diagram of what Link looks like today, right? So there are two dimensions, I would say, and we'll talk a lot about dimensions today. You know, it's like string theory for Link, if you will. I have, you know, lots of pictures of dimensions here. But one particular breakdown you can do for Link is the amount of typing you have, like as in type system, and I will abbreviate that using Greek letter tau.
Okay.
And the number of operators that you have, and let me call that number of SQO, the standard query operators. And so the question is, where are we in this space?
Yes.
With Link today? And I would say, on the typing dimension, I will sort of divide it into... Oops, this is kind of broken. I will divide it into three sections.
Okay.
This is maybe not a discrete domain. Let's actually be clear about that. You know, it's more like a gradual thing. Mm-hmm. But so what we have in here is, at this level, I would say we just have functions. You know, in C#, you would say it's delegates. In here, we have more of the object-oriented principles. And one of the things that we have there, I will categorize it as object-oriented, is interfaces. Hmm. And this is an interesting discussion by itself. If you introduce to somebody who's new to C#, for example, what a delegate is, typically people say it's a one-method interface. Like, you know, yeah, sure. It's like a contract that you have between a caller and a callee, and it needs to have this signature. Mm. And some other languages say, well, we don't have delegates. We just have one-method interfaces. To an extent that recent evolutions in those languages actually go all the way to having lambda expressions be equal to one-method interfaces, like, you know, the assignability of a lambda expression in the proposal for the next version of Java, mm-hmm. is that it will be compatible with anything that has one virtual method, which means you can use a lambda for a runnable, which is the, you know, thread concept that we call thread start. Mm-hmm. So they go in the direction of, you know, treating a delegate as a special case of an interface. In the functional world, you would go the opposite direction. You would say, well, the essential element is a function.
Yeah.
And an interface is just a record of functions. It's like name value pairs, like in JavaScript, right? In JavaScript, if you write something like, you know, x dot y, this, well, really what you're writing is, look up a member called y in the dictionary of members on x, and then invoke it. It's like you would have a delegate-typed function or a delegate-typed property in C#. Like, you're doing a property lookup at that point, and then you're invoking the delegate. So it's sort of the other way around. And then you have more, you know, extraordinary-type systems, and I will indicate those using an asterisk. An asterisk is also used in certain type systems to indicate the kind of a type. Higher kinding is one of the things we have there. So I will talk about this dimension later on, but definitely we're in this camp. If we talk about Link today, we're in this band. You know, we are doing object-oriented programming, and we are using interfaces like IEnumerable, IObservable to do things.
Yes.
Right? Now, on the standard query operator level, it's more about a quantity. I would say, like, less than 10 operators, we're definitely not in that camp. We're not at the camp that we have, you know, just a couple of operators. I think today we have like 50 or so operators. Mm-hmm. And this thing is going upwards even. Like, it's in .NET 4 we just added zip, but then we have like what our team is doing, like reactive extensions, interactive extensions. We're adding a lot of operators, which is great because it's about a toolkit, right? You know, you want to have a good toolkit that you can just draw something out or take something out of the drawer and just have a solution that's ready to go. So we are more in the high, you know, the high regions of this thing. So where Link today is, I would say it's sort of sitting here. And it's maybe moving upwards a little bit as well. So we have, you know, thanks to Rx and Ix, we've moved a little bit higher, but we are still in this interface camp. Mm-hmm. So the exercise I want to do here is sort of move this thing to, you know, let me put the sweet spot here. The sweet spot would be here for MinLink.
Okay.
To be, you know, academically interesting, I would say. It's just that, you know, it's distilling what's the essence, right?
Yes.
You know? And sort of learn things about that. And once you know that, well, it's fine to be here because you want an edge toolkit. You just don't want only a go-to. You want an if, a do while, and all of that stuff, to use that analogy. But knowing that those things boil down to jumps, that's sort of something that's of intellectual interest.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we want to go. And so we will do that in two ways, and I will actually split up the discussion in two dimensions. I will discuss how we reduce types, like get rid of the interfaces. And this will actually show us where the duality between enumerable and observable comes from, at a much clearer level. And then we'll also go downwards, sort of reducing the number of operators to a stunning three. And with three operators, we can do about 90% of what Link is doing today.
Wow.
I will say the interactive kind of Link, because I will ignore the time dimension of scheduling.
Mm.
Like, that's something I will sweep under the carpet.
Okay.
So that's sort of the picture that we want to go to.
Okay.
I'll talk a little bit about MAT, but let's first sort of explain a little bit of the complications we have at the type level. And then I'll go into this part. So maybe we should move a little bit towards that side. So when you look at type systems, I would say that today you have at least three dimensions. First dimension, and I will actually go in terms of the evolution of the CLR here.
Okay.
And I will actually come to the conclusion I can only accommodate for two of the dimensions.
Okay.
And the third dimension would make life so much easier, but then we are talking about something that only one language does, which is Haskell. So, you know, we are going to the more exotic kind of stuff.
Sure.
But so, the number of ways you could extend types, the way you could sort of reason about types in CLR 1.0 was like a one single pivot of inheritance. You say, like, you know, in object-oriented programming, which we had in .NET 1,
mm-hmm.
you really have, you know, you have a class and you have, you know, you basically have this relationship, the subtyping relationship. You know, you have some type that has a partial order based on other types. Like, you know, everything derives from object, so object is the top type. And then a string derives from that, and a student derives from an object as well, and so on and so on. So you had this one dimension to work on, and in C#, it's, you know, indicated using the colon syntax, right? You know, something implements something or inherits from something. So that's the dimension we had in CLR 1.0. In CLR 2.0, a dimension was added with Project Gyro, which was introducing generics. It's the work of Don Syme and Andrew Kennedy at Microsoft Research in Cambridge originally to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually comes, you know, has a relation with type system theory known as System F. And that's like universal quantification. What that says is, well, you know, I have some type called C of T, which is a class parameterized in T. Well, for any T, I can cook you up some C of T. Concrete sample, list of T. You can have a list of int, a list of string, whatever. And you can constrain that T a little bit. Not too much, but you can constrain it a little bit. So that's an additional sort of pivot of extensibility. Now you can parameterize a type in other types. Now, what you can't parameterize on yet is that C thing. You can't say, I'm going to express some laws that hold for any M of T, whatever that M is. And that's where we get into, you know, other kinds of type system. I'm using kind here a little bit, you know, in duplicate meaning of the word.
Okay.
Because there you get into things that you will find in Haskell, where you talk about the kind of a type and higher kinding and all of that stuff. Haskell type classes, all of that stuff is on a different pivot.
Mm.
And that's something we don't quite have in the CLR. Now, one of the implications of that is that people redo the work for Link in lots of places. They say, well, I want to have an IEnumerable link and an IObservable link and a link to SQL and a link to this and that. Well, for all of those domains, you have to implement where and select based on some particular C of T. You say, I have a where that works on my enumerable of T, and I have a where that works on, you know, I queryable of T and I observable of T, and so on and so on. You can't parameterize over M of T, saying, as long as M obeys certain laws, like having a select many and having a return, I can give you where for free, and I can give you select for free. We can't say that you have to implement those for all those different domains. Which, in quite some cases, just boils down to additional duplication of signatures. It still feels the same to the user, right? You know, you can still use link syntax to target all of those domains. Mm-hmm. It's just at the implementation side, it's a little harder. So that's sort of, you know, the picture that we have. And we are definitely, you know, with link, we are at this space, which sort of coincides with modern object-oriented programming, which is C of T, I enumerable of T, I observable of T. Let me actually put those two things in here. So I will only talk about I enumerable and I observable of T.
Okay.
Of course, link can work over other things. We've seen link to Z3, for example, last time.
Mm-hmm.
So it perfectly applies to that world as well.
Did you get link to Foundation Solver done yet?
We're working on that.
Okay. Solver Foundation, at, yes. Excuse me.
We're looking at that. And
just playing.
So sorry. Figuring out what we
of
can do.
Of course you are.
Yep.
Yes. All right, so we see this picture.
Yep.
It's a good one.
So now, let me actually go back to the duality and get my link here for a second. What's the relationship between those two things? And actually, I've drawn a diagram before that sort of introduces that. So the diagram that we had on the whiteboard when I introduced Ike observable, which is the homoiconic form of Ike observable,
yeah,
and the dual form of Ike queryable, I introduced this particular picture. Let me, can okay. I use higher?
Yes, yeah. You can.
Okay, so the picture I had there was, again, three dimensions. I have three dimensions on types, I have two dimensions for link, I have three dimensions to zoom into this. Like it's
and everything's getting, connected together by strings.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Okay.
That's all you could say. So we had the following things. We had what the kind of data is we're talking about. And at that point, I made some cross simplification. I said, this is a discrete domain that consists of two things, push-based data and pool-based data. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've seen last time when I talked about link to Z3 that this is not necessarily how the world looks. You can have different kinds of data models or data acquisition modes, if you will. That's sort of what it's about. How does the data come to me? And, you know, it's essentially push or pull. But it's also like, you know, what the data is intrinsically. Is it a database on disk? Is it a stream of data? Like, that's all stuff that can sort of be categorized in the what field. So we're going to ignore, you know, that further distinction over here and just focus on those two guys. Then we had, you know, how we represent our queries. And there we just have two things, really. Either we represent a query to execute just as is, using iterators in C# 2.0, for example, and we'll talk about iterators as well later on. So I'm doing a little sketch pad here, not to forget anything.
Good.
And we have expression trees. And now we can fill in this diagram, the pool-based form of, you know, using IL code, is I enumerable of T. The homoiconic form of that is I queryable of T, which means you can take a look at the expression trees. And basically this is connected. Some people say it's reification, you know, like you can use lots of expensive words to sort of talk about the relationship between those two things. And then in the push-based world, we have I observable of T, which is connected to I enumerable as you know, a duality. And we have I observable of T over here, which again has a duality and a homoiconicity. Like, those are the two things, and you can always go back, you know, to watch the video on my observable. We are going to ignore that part today.
Okay.
We're just going to look at that.
Okay.
We also had where things execute, which is the notion of a scheduler. And the notion of a scheduler is a totally separate thing, which is needed to introduce, you know, concurrency in the system such that you can do certain things where a lot of things are going.
Sure.
But if that's exactly at the same time, like multi-threading on multiple CPUs, or it's creating an illusion that doesn't matter. It's just about introducing concurrency in the system. So here we have the notion of a scheduler, and I'm going to ignore that one as well.
Okay.
So we're just going to focus on this little thing over here. So where should we go from here? I guess we should take a look at the functions or the types of those guys. So let's get rid of those types, because it's a little too complicated to clearly see what the difference is between those two things.
Okay.
So I'll actually get rid of some parts here. I will keep that because that's our overview diagram. Mm-hmm. That we can sort of say where we are. We're just going to contest those two things right now.
Okay.
So let me actually write down the two interfaces really quick, right? Black is fine?
Black is great.
Okay. So we have an interface called IEnumerable of T. And that guy has, you know, a getEnumerator, which gets an IEnumerator of T. And it's called getEnumerator, right? And then we have an interface IEnumerator of T. And we've seen this before, so I'm not going to talk too much about it,
mm-hmm.
which has boolean move next and has a T current with a getter. Okay. So that's the interface. You can look it up in the BCL. It also has a reset method over here, which doesn't matter. I'll just ignore that. Now, a couple of things is like, those are interfaces. Those are in the middle section over here.
Mm-hmm.
So what I want to do is I want to get rid of interfaces and reduce it to a function. Because people don't really see how the data is flowing. Like, given this thing, how do I get to T values?
Mm.
Like, okay, you have to get an enumerator, and then you have to call move next, and then get in case that thing returns true. Like, that's why people can get confused about those things. So what I want to do is I want to introduce, and it's not a prank, it's actually what I've been doing. Instead of enumerable, I want to have numerable. What does that mean?
That means Bart has finally gone crazy.
Yes.
I'm just playing. All right.
Numerable. Or
enumerable. Wow. Enumerable.
Yeah.
Okay.
So what's that?
Yes.
Well, IEnumerable stands for an interface that's enumerable.
Okay.
Phenumerable stands for a function that represents something enumerable.
Okay.
It's just a prefix to say, I will just do it using functions.
Okay.
So, how do we get to the data from this point? I will ignore errors. In reality, you have something like throws exception over here. Let's ignore that part as well. Because you can always encode exceptions in that T. You could say it's a T or an exception by creating some exception or value of T thing with a boolean that says has exception.
Okay.
And you could go one step further to denote the boolean returning false, saying there's no value to follow. Well, now you got back to notification of T in, you know, Rx.
Mm.
Notification of T is on error, on next, or on completed. It's basically discriminated union of those three things. So you can encode this whole thing sort of quite easily. But the thing is, in order to get to the data, you have to call first over here. You have to call getEnumerator.
Mm.
You have to call using nothing. You know, nothing as the input. You need to get an enumerator. And then from the enumerator to get to the next value, what you have to do is you have to call this move next thing, and then you get a boolean. And if that thing is true, you can get the value. Or if it's false, it means there's nothing to follow. So you have to call a function to get the enumerator, you have to call a function to move next, and then you get a result.
Mm.
How can we write this down? Well, we can say it's a function that takes in nothing, that returns a function that takes in nothing, and returns a T or null. I will use nullable syntax here. This nullable syntax is not quite working out that well because it doesn't work for reference types.
Mm.
So I will just say this is just some notation.
Okay.
In reality, it would do something like option of T or maybe of T, which is like in F-sharp, you have option of T actually built in. So you could basically write this pretty easily. And this thing is sort of the same as a push-based sequence of any number of T's. T star, using clean, you know, symbols.
Okay.
T star means zero or more T's, right? And T question means, well, every time you call those things, you get one or zero values. And if you do that multiple times, you get any number of values, right? So that's basically the signature of phenumerable. It's essentially a function that if you call it, you get another function, which is the enumerator.
Mm-hmm.
And if you call that guy, you get the data out. Now, how do you write it in C sharp? Well, you write it as func of option of T. That's actually how you would write it.
Hmm.
Looks kind of nice. You call it, you get an enumerator, which is a function by itself. You call that thing, which represents the move next method, and you get the next value, or there's nothing to follow. Now, how do you dualize that? How do you make that into an observable? You basically flip inputs and outputs. So what do you do? Well, I will actually use green this time. What you end up with is T question mark goes to nothing, goes to nothing. Which is, again, you know, it's a T star, but this time it's pushed at you, and here you have to pull it out. Sort of a difference is in the way you use
and
it.
What you just wrote down there for the people who don't, in some sense, it's all based on category theory, this whole duality thing you guys are exploring deeply here. But you just flip the arrows around.
Just flip the
arrows really
around.
All you've done.
Exactly. That's the only thing I've done.
But that's profound,
it's like
what it means.
Doing this and doing this. And then we have the new type. Now, if you look at this thing, that's iObservable. What's iObservable? It's something that if you give it an observer, it returns an iDisposable. I ignored the iDisposable. I have to be honest about that. I didn't include the iDisposable. You could do it quite easily. You make this into a tuple. A tuple that says, here's the way how you get the next value,
okay,
and here's the way how you dispose it. iDisposable, by the way, has signature nothing goes to nothing. It's like void dispose of nothing. That's the signature of iDisposable. It's actually, iDisposable is the same as action, the action delegate. Which it doesn't take in anything, doesn't produce anything. Of course, in reality, in Haskell, this wouldn't quite work. In Haskell, you would have to write IO of unit, saying that there is a side effect. Otherwise, you know, nothing goes to nothing. There's no reason to execute that thing in a pure functional language.
Sure.
In a pure functional language, what does this mean? That means make your CPU halt. Nothing else. It doesn't produce a meaningful result. It doesn't take anything in. You could go even as far as what's the signature of C star applications. Static void main with no arguments. That means you can toss away the whole program because it's not going to do anything useful from a purely functional point of view. It's going to return nothing given nothing. So in reality, those things also are in the I.O. monads, which is a totally separate discussion. But you would have to annotate things with I.O. over here as well, because there are side effects going on.
Sure.
Otherwise, if there wouldn't be a side effect, this function would always have to return the same T value, which means you only can have infinite streams, which always return the same thing. Clearly, this thing has an I.O. thing, which might mean it's going to the database, or it's fetching something from the enumerator. But so in this world, we have iObservable back.
Okay.
iObservable is something that takes in an observer and returns an iDisposable, ignoring that detail. It's not that much of a detail because you want to be able to shut down this subscription, but let's ignore that. And an observer, well, actually it takes in a T or nothing and returns nothing. What does that mean? Well, that's onNext and onCompleted sort of condensed to a single function. Of course, you can have on error as well. Well, then you just encode the error in the T as well somehow. So that's all we have. And this thing, if you write it down in C-sharp syntax, this thing is an action of an action of an option of T. It's an action that takes in an action, which takes in an option of T. Look at the beauty of that. Like here, it's a func of an option. Here, it's an action of an option. So minlink is implemented on those two things. We don't use interfaces at all. We say we're going to implement standard sequence operators over functions. We have extension methods on func of option of T. That's called select and where and all of those things. And they return a new func of option of T. So that's where we are playing. And so we've actually mission accomplished. We've gotten rid of the interfaces, and we got into this quadrant. Now we still want to get rid of an excessive number of operators. And that's the next thing to talk about.
Okay.
So before we go there, I want to talk a little bit about math. Maybe we should sit down and sort of discuss this in some, you know, conversational setting.
Okay.
And then we'll talk about, you know, how we get from here to there, which is like reducing the number of operators to 3. And then you can do everything. Well, not everything, but 90% at least.
Perfect. So going towards the the link kernel.
Yes,
will,
exactly.
We have now removed interface.
Exactly.
And we have gotten ourselves with functions and actions.
Yep.
And exactly. Functions, specifically.
Yep.
Excellent, man. Mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see how you're going to go down into towards
down
the
into
zero.
Yep, exactly.
But 0-0 is where we're aiming for, man.
Exactly.
Or 1-1.
Yes, or 1-1, yes.
Although, yeah, but that's just the two dimensions.
Yep.
As you mentioned, there's many more. But mathematics, so let's talk about this, because
yes.
I know you work for Eric. Mm-hmm. You guys are math heads.
Oh, yes, sort of.
You know... Yeah. Talk to me. What's going on? We know about duality and
exactly.
stuff like that, but that's...
And I want to sort of connect it back to things that people know from high school mathematics.
Okay.
Because, like, this is just beautiful API design in some sense. Like, you know, you should sort of love the way this falls together. And the mathematical details, they don't really matter that much if you're just using it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's about having a feeling for a certain API and carrying over that feeling to some other world.
Yeah.
And it just feels natural. So there are two things I have to call out about mathematics, which are just beautiful. I would say it's vector spaces, which is about, you know, creating a set of base vectors that can describe an entire space.
Mm-hmm.
And those base vectors need to be carefully chosen, so I'll talk about that. And the second thing is the ability to convert between different domains,
okay.
which here we're seeing with iObservable and iEnumerable. Like, how do you go between those two? So the first thing, the vector spaces thing, is like, it's best that you choose constructions that are totally orthogonal concerns. Like, in the world of iEnumerable and iObservable, that notion of an iScheduler is something that's totally orthogonal to the way you get to the data. It's like, you don't want to somehow built in the notion of scheduling in observables, because then you've sort of collapsed your space and those two are intertwined and you can't separate them out. And so it's the idea of sort of choosing basic principles that you sort of build together and that are orthogonal. And so that's exactly one of the things I've shown in the diagram when I was actually talking about, you know, iObservable and all of that stuff. We say, oh, and by the way, there's a scheduling axis. And I'm not going to talk about that right now, but it's really that those two things are totally separate constructions.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing holds for iObservable and iObserver. iObservable and iObserver, well, we have this thing called the subject, which combines the two. If that would be the only thing we have, that wouldn't be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Because then, you know, you're sort of stuck in a world where you only have one abstraction which sort of fits two goals. But you can never separate the two goals. Like, that thing has an onNext and onAir, onComplete, and a subscribe. Like, if you just want to give somebody the ability to subscribe, it doesn't work, because you've tied together all of these constructions. So that's the thing of orthogonality. I really like that as an API design thing, because you end up with a minimum set of, you know, constructions
mm-hmm.
that you can combine in any way to get to more flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, have an observable and a scheduler, well, then you can do time-based operations. But if you don't have a scheduler, you can still do where. Where doesn't care about time. It just takes a look at the value and says, am I going to propagate it, yes or no? Or am I going to return it when you do yield return and for each?
Mm.
So that's that domain. Second thing is the conversions. And I like that a lot as well. Because in that world where you have truly different constructions, like, you know, and separation of concerns like iObservable and iEnumerable, like, some problems are more natural to express in one domain versus the other. So isn't it nice that you can sort of round trip? And that's something that people do in mathematics all the time. Let me give you an example. If I ask somebody on the street, what's the multiplication of 32 and 128? People stare at me and it's like, it's way too difficult. People experience multiplication as being difficult. And you can ask, you know, everyone in high school. They will, you know, that they've just learned, or, you know, kindergarten or wherever you learn to multiply in the mathematical sense. Those things really are, you know, difficult. It's addition is simpler than multiplication. So what's it take to do 32 times 128? You convert it to a different domain. You say, like, 32 is 2 power 5. 128 is 2 power 7. I'm a computer scientist. I know that just by looking at it. 32, that's 5. 128, that's 7. Number of bits. But now you have 2 power 5 times 2 power 7. How do you multiply two things which have an exponent? You just add the two things together. You do 5 plus 7, mm-hmm. which is 12. And 2 power 12, well, I do know that as well. 2 power 10 is 1 kilobyte, and 2 power 2 is 4, so it's 4 kilobytes. So 32 times 128 is 4096. And I haven't done any decibel mod here, I just converted to base 2. So to make my life easier and get rid of multiplications, I went all the way to some other domain,
mm-hmm.
where it's easier to do, because now it becomes an addition instead of a multiplication. And that's exactly the same, you know, with those nice API designs. Think about AMP, the ambiguous operator in Link, specifically introduced in Reactor extensions. What does AMP do? Well, you have two sequences, and you AMP them together, like two stock tickers,
mm-hmm.
which can produce the same result. It's two stock brokers. And you want to get, you know, the result for Microsoft as soon as possible. Well, you AMP them together, which means ambiguous. Now, when you subscribe to the AMP of the two sequences, we subscribe to both of them and let them race for the result. And the first one to propagate a result is the one we are going and run with. So it's a race between two cars, which means that the two cars need to move independent of each other, right? You're not going to chain two cars together in order to make them race. You want them to move independently, which means you need some scheduling and all that stuff. Now, how are you going to do AMP on enumerables? It's harder, because this doesn't have the notion of asynchrony sort of baked in. In the world of enumerables, like say that you have two SQL servers, one in Australia and one in the USA, and they both contain exactly the same data. And now you're somewhere in the world and you want to get the data as fast as possible. So you're going to launch the query against the two servers. And the first one to respond is the one you want to run with. Well, what do you have to do AMP between those two things? You have to call move next on one and move next on the other. But once you're calling move next on one, you're stuck. So you have to introduce concurrency. So the world of observables, where you have operators that take in schedulers, is much nicer for that kind of problem. So are you going to implement this AMP thing in enumerables? No, you're going to say, well, take your first enumerable sequence and make it an observable by using two observable. Now you're in a different domain. Do that for the second one as well. AMP them together over here in the observable domain. You get a new observable, and then you can do two enumerable to go back. So you've round-tripped, and that's much easier than going directly. The direct route is very hard. You need to do synchronization, locks, and all of those kind of primitives, which is very hard to get right. But if you go to observables, you can leverage the things that we've already done there. We've invested in schedulers. The AMP operator is safe to be used there. Like, it's much easier to go with a little round trip. And people use that trick all the time. Like, you know, I have, you know, a civil engineering background and, you know, learned at some point systems and signals. Well, people do things with Fourier analysis and Fourier calculus over there all the time. And when you're analyzing systems and signals, which are transformations between, you know, it's a function of functions, it's kind of higher order in that world. Sometimes it's easier to do things in the time domain, sometimes it's easier to do it in the frequency domain. Well, sometimes the trick is just to go from one to the other, and then do the simpler thing over there and then go backwards. Like, it's like you have to answer your question on the exam, right? And you say, like, well, let me rephrase your question first. And, like, this is what you really meant. And it's much easier to implement it over there. And then you say, by the way, footnote, to go back to the original question, you just apply this rule.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what I did with the logarithm thing as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like a table lookup. You say, what's 32 times 128? Well, you just rephrase it. It's the same as 2 power 5 and 2 power 7, which are table lookups. Like, it's just active knowledge. Like, that's the recipe to go from here to there.
Mm-hmm.
Then you say, now it's addition, because that's how it works. And then you go back, and you say 2 power 12, well, 12, table lookup, 4096. So that round-tripping thing is another piece of beauty. And I think it's great that, you know, for example, I enumerable and I observable have those tight connections. You can go in both directions.
Hmm.
It's kind of deep, because it's about introducing and reducing concurrency. So those arrows to go from enumerable to observable and backwards are parameterized on schedulers.
Hmm.
At least one is, you know, to go from enumerable to observable, because we need to introduce concurrency. But once you've done that, you're in another world where the grass can be greener for certain types of scenarios.
Absolutely.
And so that's actually, you know, two of the guiding principles, and they sort of shine through in a different dimension on the whiteboard. I'm not pointing them out explicitly, but they are there, and you know there are arrows between all of those things.
Excellent, and again, that's an outstanding explanation. It's in some sense, really, the essence of all of this is duality, or you could look at it that duality is, I hate to say the monad of duality, because I'm starting to go a little crazy.
Yeah.
You guys have poisoned my mind over the years.
That's what we've done.
But in some sense, all I wanted to say was, it shows you sort of the unbelievably powerful, simple and beautiful element of just switching arrows around.
Exactly.
Like you did up there, because essentially that's what you did when you said, what's 128 times 32?
Exactly.
You switched arrows around because you turned them into a domain-specific comprehension, which is you know base 2 and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a computer person. You studied engineering. I mean, it's not rocket science. Mm-hmm. But to another person, they could switch the domain to something else.
Yeah. It's what people do to, you know, do an answer and response in a foreign language, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, I don't know Spanish that much, actually not at all, but assume I do speak a little Spanish.
Uh-huh.
Somebody is asking me a question in Spanish.
Yeah.
Likely I'm applying the arrow to translate it to English, then think in English, because my brain is much more flexible to think in English, and then go back to Spanish to formulate the answer. It's about flipping arrows and in such a way that people don't even have to see it. Like, you know, I don't have to reveal that I don't speak Spanish that well.
Mm-hmm.
I can reason in English, and that's an implementation detail. Right.
By the way, I really like your shirt.
So
I want to kind of zoom in on that.
Okay.
You know, this is Channel 9. We're humans here.
Exactly.
So that says...
At least most people think we are.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. Great shirt, man.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of which, let's iterate once again.
Yes.
And now you gave us that nice mathematical lesson. I think that was very clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's talk just a little bit about what we are going to do right now.
Perfect.
Right? And then we'll get up here.
Great.
What we want to do is reduce the number of operators. Like, you know, 50 operators, way too much.
Yeah.
I just want to get, you know, essentials. I'm not saying way too much for practical reasons. For practical reasons, it's great that you have, like, off-the-shelf components, right? You know, you could say I only need a UI framework that can draw rectangles or triangles, and I can do every kind of control. It might be still useful to have a hexagon built in, right? So we want to reduce it to like three core things, and we'll explain what those are. But I want people to think about how you would implement link in C Sharp 1.0. Let's say C Sharp 1.0 together with generics, which isn't quite C Sharp 2.0 because there are more things in C Sharp 2.0. But so say you have generics, so you have I enumerable of T, and now you want to implement, say, for example, where. Okay? So how do you do that? Well, today you say, I'm going to use iterators in C#, which were introduced in C# 2.0, which is before link. Kind of interesting that they weren't introduced at the point of link. So the way to implement it would be you do for each over the source, and you yield return if the function evaluates the true. It's like for each var item in the source, if the predicate for the item is true, then yield return the item. That's all you do. But it's kind of complicated the way it works internally. Assume that you don't have iterators and you want to implement where. Well, you have to thread state around, build your own little state machine. And you know, people can learn about that a lot because we've talked about it in the context of async in C# vNext.
Yes.
It's exactly the same kind of logic that's being used in the compiler there. So it's a lot of plumbing to get right. Now assume that you don't have iterators and you have to implement link to objects. How are you going to do it? Are you going to craft a state machine for where? One for select, one for select many, one for group by, one for order. Like, it just gets out of hand very quickly if you have to do all of that manual stuff over there. You were just lucky enough that we had iterators at the time we did link, because it made it so much easier to write all of those standard query operators. But assume you don't have iterators. You can still do it. It's just, you know, given an IEnumerable, you need to return an IEnumerable, which contains the logic that's lazy. When you call move next, only at that point you can go to the source sequence to get the next element, or maybe multiple elements till you get something that passes the filter. But it's very complicated. So assume this world doesn't have iterators. Could we get rid of where and select and all of those operators by just implementing a single operator and then building where and select on top of that. So basically building a complex state machine once and for all, and then build lots of operators on top of that, that just trivially pass arguments around and maybe swap a couple of things, but like just a trivial forward between function calls, right? As opposed to having their own implementation. And so that's what we're sort of going to try to do here.
Nice.
So let's actually give it a shot.
Okay.
Right? I should officially do it using those, but I have the implementation laying around, you know, of func of option of t-based link, mm-hmm. and I'll actually give the URL later on. It's called, you know, mintlink on link standard query operators. I actually have it on CodePlex.
Nice.
So people can just go there, look at it. So I'm not going to give the implementation really per se. I'm going to say which operators are related. And so the way you can categorize all of the operators in link to objects is there are like three main categories. And they have to do with monads, of course. So let's actually draw it at this side.
Okay.
So what's a monad? I've explained before. A monad of T is something. When you apply a certain operator, you end up in the monad again. Let's say it like that. It's like a ship you can't leave.
Okay.
Now, in order to start doing things there, you need to get onto the ship to begin with. So you go from a T to M of T. Now, let's be concrete. Let's go for enumerable of T, right? Enumerable I will abbreviate as T star. It's a sequence of T's.
Okay.
How do you get something into T star given a single T? It's create an array with a single value. Like, you know, if you write new square brackets and then 42, well, now you have an enumerable of int. And now you can start using link. So that's a way to get in. There are other ways to get in here that don't start with an enumerable to begin with. This is actually an arrow that's about factories, right? It's a factory method, if you will. It's how do you get something in there? So we need some way to do a factory. And another sample of a factory is enumerable.range. Enumerable.range from 0 to 10. Well, 10 is the length, so it's 0 to 9 inclusive. This is some way to actually get an enumerable of ins out, but I didn't start here with enumerables. I started with scalar values.
Hmm.
So you need a way to get in. So let's talk about that in just a second, how we can sort of generalize that, like enumerable.range is one of them. But you can have many others, like enumerable.repeat of a single value. That's also a factory. You say, I want to repeat 100 times. That's really like a loop that does yield return 100 times. But I don't want iterators all the time. I just want one primitive that's about getting into it. Now, the next thing I want is a way to compose, where I say, given a T star and some kind of function, I want to get back to another kind of T star. And that's called select many. What select many does is it takes a T star and a function from T to R star, and then you get back an R star. So this thing now is an R star if you apply that. What does that mean? Starting with a list of products, and for every product you can get all the orders, you can get a flat list of orders.
Mm.
That's essentially what select many is. That's actually the bind of monads. So that's the second one we actually want. Let me actually write this in red. That's bind. And then finally we need a way to get out. The way to get out of this thing is to go back to some scalar value t, if you will. And there are different ways to get out. Like one way is to do for each over an enumerable sequence or subscribe on an observable sequence. But other operators include, like, for example, sum. Whether or not sum should go out is a different question. We've debated that, like, when we talked about Rx. We say, in the world of Rx, sum still returns an I observable of t. It's sort of in this category, where you start from an iObservable of T and you go back to an iObservable of T, which then happens to contain a single value, but it's still asynchronous, which makes it possible to cancel out that computation.
Mm.
While as in link to SQL, if you write something like, give me the average price of all the products, well, at the point you do dot average, we're going to the server, and you can't cancel it. It's synchronous. It's going. Mm. Like, you can't cancel it out. So in the world of Rx, it would actually not leave here, but you still want a way to leave when you subscribe, for example. And so this is close to, in Haskell, unsafe perform IO, you know, which is getting out of this world. And here you have things like aggregates and stuff. Now we can sort of, let me actually say this, this is escape. Now, those are the three things. If we have those things, we can do a lot of stuff. Where, for example, is in this gap? It goes from a T star to a T star. Select goes from a T star to an R star, just projecting every single value T to something else. Some average, you know, min, max, all of those guys and linked to objects are in this gap. Innumerable range, innumerable repeat is in this gap. So if you have those three things, you can do a lot of stuff. Order by you can actually do using this. Order by is kind of weird. It goes from a T star to a T star. How do you do that? Well, here you only see one element at a time. Where can you enforce the order? Well, the way you do that is you could say, I'm going to take T star into a sorted list of T, which is sort of getting out, and then go back in. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, sort of make an escape. It's maybe not the cleanest way to do it, but it's a way to do it. Now, it turns out we can give those more fancy names. You know, that's what we have to do.
I bet.
Yes. So, bind, we'll just call bind. That's fine. This guy, and now I'm actually referring to Eric Meyer's thesis.
Ah.
You know, he had a paper called Functional Programming with Bananas, Lenses, Barbed Wire, and Envelopes.
Yes.
I don't know the precise order, but you
doesn't
know...
doesn't matter. It's one of the best titles ever.
Yes. Yeah. I'm going to refer to the first two, actually.
Okay.
Which is the Bananas and Lenses, which are known as anamorphisms and catamorphisms. Now, what those guys are is... an anamorphism is like an unfold. It's a generalization of an unfold. It's like you have a value that's condensed, you know, it's a single thing, mm-hmm. and then you start opening it up into a sequence. So that's like, you know, you have an accordion that's closed, and then you open it, and then all of a sudden you see all of those things coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's unfold. A catamorphism, like the word catastrophe, is like going from something huge and then all of a sudden condensing it into one little thing. Like, that's the generalization of a fold. So in functional languages, you would call this fold.
Okay.
And so those are the things. Let's actually give the signatures. Like this first thing, the factory, basically goes from a T to a T star. But in reality, we want to have more functionality here. Like, it's not just a single value that goes to a T star. It's like some value factory. And here you can actually look, for example, at observable. You can look at generate. The generate function is basically a for loop. It's like, while a certain function that goes from a T to a boolean is true, execute the function that goes from T to the next T. Also, give me some start value. So, like, it's for int I is T, or from T I equals the starting value, while something holds, that's like the condition, while this thing holds, this is the next one, the increment. Like, you know, it's really like you write this, right? For int I is 0, while I is lower than 10i++. That's like those three functions, the original value, the condition, and the way to go to the next value. And then you have something that actually goes from T to R, which is basically the selector, which in this thing, in the body of this piece of code, would be yield return I, for example.
Okay.
So this is actually enumerable dot range from 0 to 10. That's exactly how it would be implemented. This would be the beginning, this would be the end, fed in, and that's just working. So you can generalize that, that's yield. You can generalize that using generate, which I will call Anna.
Okay.
So this Anna thing is about getting values in. I'm just, you know, generalizing this a little bit. Now, the way you implement enumerable range is just as I've shown you. You just feed in whatever the user is giving you, some stopping condition, this is the I++ function, and this is just the identity. How do you do observable or enumerable return? That's just returning a single value, right? Enumerable return would be something like, for this value I, you just give it the value on the return. This T goes to bool thing needs to return true the first time, but false the second time. And then going to the next one I don't care about because there's only a single value, and returning the value will be the identity. So you can do enumerable dot range, you can implement easily using this guy, enumerable dot return, which is the single array kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not writing in there, you know, new array of the value. I'm actually calling into this ANA function. So I'm basically layering all the ways to get into this world on top of this one single function, which is called generate, just by having nice substitutions. How do you do an infinite sequence? Enumerable dot repeat without a count. Well, that's kind of simple. You basically call generate, where this function, I don't even care about t in that world. I just say a generate for which the yield return returns my value. And here, my condition, my stopping condition will be, you know, what does this thing do? I lower than 10. So when this thing is false, it breaks. So you basically return true here, meaning continue, 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 just a constant true. So you just make this thing constant true, this thing constant, whatever you want to repeat, and you have an infinite sequence.
Hmm.
You don't have to implement all of those things manually. They all inherit from the base implementation, if you will. So that's layering for that guy. Pretty simple. How does this guy work? This kata thing. This kata thing already exists. It's basically accumulate and link. Mm. The accumulate method looks a lot like this guy, just upside down. It's really like that. So what it does, it takes in an accumulator starting value.
Okay.
It takes in a way to combine an accumulator value and a T value into the next accumulator value. And it also takes in a way to get the accumulator value into the result value. This is like a loop again, right? It's like start with value A, then for every T, call this function given the current A going to the next A. That's like mutation. But it's not mutating, it's just, you know, going to the next state using a function call and just assigning it. And then at the end, once you're out of that loop for all of the elements in the sequence, you return whatever this result selector does. So like for a sum, this thing would become 0. This thing would become A, B goes to A plus B. And this result thing would be the identity. So you can implement sum using that. You can implement min, max, all of those guys. Like, so I invite people to implement, for example, min, and let's actually write a couple. Min, sum, any is also one of those guys. Like, all of those you can implement using this thing. So that's a whole bunch, a whole bucket of them that you can implement using this. For example, also, instead of any, you can also have all, which is, you know, the universal predicate, right? You know, evaluate the condition there. Well, this combiner function somehow will contain this thing, right? The short-circuiting end. You can't break from this loop prematurely in this world. Like, you might want to have some additional function which is a stopping condition to make it a little more smooth and more performant in certain cases. But that's the essence of it again. It's like starting with a sequence of T's that are iterated one by one and reducing it to an R. That's here. Going from a T sequence to an R. I just called it T over here to denote a single value. That's basically it. And then the select many guy, the bind one, is the most interesting of all. We keep the best for the last, right?
Mm-hmm.
This one allows you to implement a lot of operators, including where and select. So let's actually give an implementation using yield return.
Okay.
People can actually find an implementation using func of option and action of option. Which is more crazy, in some sense. Because you don't have that state machine thing. You have to keep the state yourself. But it's all local.
Mm.
Because what I'm the way you implement one of those guys, a func of option, which is the same as an enumerable, is like you do something like this, right? Return nothing goes to, and then you do some stuff here, and then you return nothing goes to, some stuff here, and here you return a T or nothing. That's how you implement those guys. Now, those are just nested lambdas. This is the getEnumerator method. So, for example, let me give you a pretty simple example.
Okay.
The way you would implement Anna, for example, in this world, would be something like, I will just sort of degeneralize it. I will do an Anna that returns a sequence of values.
Okay.
So I will do something, when you do getEnumerator, I will actually have a variable int I, which starts off as 0. So when you do getEnumerator, you have that thing in scope. It's not sitting outside. It's not a global I that's shared by all the enumerators of the sequence. So every time you do getEnumerator, you get a new I. This is the same as a class definition. This is the same as implementing IEnumerable of T with getEnumerator in here, and then the enumerator object has an I in a field, which is what yield return will do by itself. Hmm. So we're sort of, you should see those curly braces as I'm implementing a class, or an interface better. And then in the return thing, this is the move next, remember? This is getEnumerator, and this thing returns a way to do move next. When you call this guy, we move to the next one. Hmm. So what I will just return here, for example, is return i++. In reality, this would be, you know, an i++ or a boolean to be able to stop. But in this case, what I've implemented here is an infinite sequence from 0 to infinity. Not really infinity. It's from 0 to, you know, int.max value, and then go back to int.min value because we're going to overflow, and then circle around because of the way it worked. Actually, I could do checked around this thing, of course. But now you have a lazy sequence that goes from 0 to max value. And basically, the first time you call it, you get int I equals 0, and then when you call move next, you get, you know, 0 out, and we increment that I. But every enumerator has its own I. So you can actually have this function f, and you can basically do something like, you know, f, e is f, call it, which is getEnumerator, and then you can do e, open bracket, e, open bracket, and this thing will return 0, this thing will return 1.
Mm.
And in this, at the same time, I could be doing something like g equals f of that thing, and I could be doing g over here, and that thing will get a 0 as well, because it's coming out of this inner thing. Everyone has its own state. We're basically, what we introduced here is a closure over that I.
Hmm.
So that's the way you implement basically this Anna thing. Now, in reality, it's a little more complex because you have terminating conditions sitting in here, all of that stuff. But that's the way it works.
Interesting.
So that's just a little detour. Let's now talk about select many.
Detour.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the select many one.
Functional composition.
Yes, that's composition on monads.
Yes.
Not composition of different monads, but composition within the monads. So select many has this signature.
Okay.
It's the same as bind in Haskell, which has looks like this, you know, it just has a weird name. Okay. It's like some people call it shove into. Like, you know, it's, you know. Now, the way it works is you start with an m of a, you get a function of a to m of b, and you go to m of b. Means, in our world, that means you start with a sequence of a's, IEnumerable of a, or observable of a. You have a function that goes from an a to an enumerable or observable of b's, and we get back an observable or enumerable of b's. Like, for example, product goes to orders, can return me orders. So that's the definition of that guy. Now, the way it's implemented in Link for enumerable is what I will write here. I will not do it using those func things. It's a little complicated in there, lots of state. I will just use yield return. And I will give those things names, of course. Let's actually call it out completely. Select many of t, r takes in an enumerable of t, which I will call the source. It takes in a func of t to enumerable of r, which is the selector, and it returns an enumerable of r. And it's a static method, and it has a this over here to make it an extension method.
Okay.
Let's ignore those things. Now, the way it works, modular exception handling on those guys, and Eric will curse at me because of that, because you know, I always, the first thing I write are the null checks. That's the last thing he writes. So
okay.
We just have a different way of thinking. But so, modular the null checks, which are actually kind of interesting because this whole thing is lazy. You want those null checks to happen eagerly while the execution is lazy.
Okay.
Something for people to think about. It's a commonly made mistake with iterators. If you do throw exception in here, that exception will only be thrown when you do move next, which is not the right time. So in reality, you need to do a little bit more. So I will ignore null checks on those guys.
Okay.
Now, the way it works is for each var t in source, I'm just going to iterate the source. Then I'm going to do for each var result in selector of t. So it's basically two loops sitting at each other. And then finally, I'm doing yield return of r. So that's the implementation of select many for enumerables. The implementation of select many for observables is quite similar, but it introduces, well, actually it doesn't introduce concurrency by itself, but all of those returned observables in the selector can be running independently of each other because it's an asynchronous world. So in that world, you get merging semantics, where select many means, given the outer observable, get me a number of inner observables and just listen to them simultaneously, which means they might be interleaved. In this case, it's sequenced because we're pulling things out. So that's just a fundamental difference in pull versus push. So that's the way this guy is implemented. Now, you might wonder, how do you write a where based on this thing? Like, the only thing I see is an enumerable of t to begin with, and I want to filter that guy. But the only thing I can play with here is a func from t to an enumerable of r. I want a func from t to bool, and if that boolean is false, I don't want to yield return it. So how do you build, and that's kind of the essence on the operation level for Mendling, how do you implement things like where and select in terms of this guy? Well, the answer is not that hard, it turns out. So let's do where first, or let's do select first. Always change my mind on this. Select of t to r takes in an enumerable of t, which is the source, and it takes in a func from t to r, that's the selector. And what it returns is an enumerable of r. There's a little mismatch here. This thing produces an r, this thing produces an enumerable of r. How do we implement this guy in terms of that guy? Well, you could try. We could do a return of select many. We don't want the many part, right, which is this thing. The enumerable part is the many part. We want to get rid of that. Source, that still type checks enumerable of t with enumerable of t. Now, what's the selector needs to be? Well, given an element out of this source, what I want to return is a sequence that contains the projected element. Well, I don't have a way to get a sequence, but I do have a way to create a single value sequence. It's just creating an array with a single element. So that's what I'm going to do here. I'm going to say x goes to, and in reality I would be using that emma thing here to do a return. So like, you know, I would be using enumerable.return, which is the encapsulation of creating a single cell array. In reality, it's even more complicated because it uses yield return inside, because it's a generalization that we're using there. But so what we're going to return here is enumerable dot return of selector of x. Yep. So that's what we do. Given any element, we return a single value which contains the call of the selector given argument x. So, an example, say that you have a sequence that starts with, that's the outer sequence source. It contains 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay.
I want to do a select plus 1. So I want to do this thing, dot select, x goes to x plus 1. How do I do that? Well, select many says I'm going to project every of those guys onto sequences themselves. Any number of values can be in those sequences, including a single value, right? Could even be empty. But that's what select many does. That's the behavior of a select many. Given a function, which is the selector over here, that's the selector going from an element to a new sequence, what it's going to do is it's going to return a sequence that iterates over all those guys this way. That's what select many does. So what we're going to do to implement select is implement the selector as something that simply returns a single value, which contains the value plus 1. It's going to do 1 goes to create a single value array or sequence that contains a 2, that contains a 3, that contains a 4, that contains a 5. And now if you iterate over that, you see 2, 3, 4, 5.
Mm-hmm.
So that's using select many to implement select. How do we implement where in this world? How do we implement this thing dot where x goes to x percent 2 equals 0 to get just the even numbers? How do we do that? Well, let's actually try. To implement where of t returns an enumerable of t, we take in an enumerable of t, which is the source, and a function from t to bool, which is the selector. How do we implement it? Well, what can we do? We only have select many as our base primitive. Go back to my discussion of iterators. Assume that we don't have iterators and we have to craft a complicated state machine ourselves. Look, it's select didn't need to craft a state machine because we use select many.
Okay.
We do the work once and for all. All of our dollars are spent here.
Okay.
And here we can just have somebody who takes the Haskell prelude and just ports every function to call select many. Like, you know, it's all the investment is over there.
I understand.
And that's the pyramid upside down thing, right? You know, where and select are sitting here and the select many is at the bottom. Now, how do we do the where? Well, again, the only thing we can call is select many. Based on the signature, it takes an enumerable, it needs to return an enumerable. It's in this camp, it's in the bind camp,
okay,
in this big picture. So we can return select many of the source. And now we need a function given an element from the source to return an inner sequence. Well, what's the inner sequence going to be? If the condition is true, it contains the value. It's a single value sequence. If the condition is false, it's an empty sequence. So this is x goes to, this is not a selector, this is a predicate. Predicate of x, ternary operator, question mark. If the predicate is true, do enumerable dot return of x, otherwise do enumerable dot empty of t. So how does this work on this sequence? Well, given 1, we evaluate this function. This function says false. This thing is false, so we return an empty sequence of an int here, which is this. Empty sequence of int. Doesn't contain anything.
Mm-hmm.
For 2, this thing returns 2. 2% 2 equals 0. So we return a single cell containing 2. For 3, we get an empty guy. For 4, we get a single cell 4. Now, if this thing threads the select many threads through all of those NX sequences, we get a sequence that reads 2, 4. So we've done a filter using select many. Just the many sometimes is nothing, mm-hmm. or sometimes one thing. So many is a superset, right? You know, it's a superset of 1 or, you know, 1 plus. Like, you know, in clean terms, you know, many can encode a single value.
Many
as well.
Is totally. Many exactly. is anything but 0.
Yep, exactly. Well, including 0.
Including 0,
yeah,
sure.
Including 0.
Fair enough.
So that's all we have. So we can implement those guys in terms of this one. And so we can do it for many other ones as well. I leave it, again, as an exercise to think about SIP, which deals with 2 input sequences.
Okay.
How do you deal with 2 input sequences? Maybe you need another primitive that deals with multiple input sequences. But once you have SIP, you can do the special versions of select. There's a special version of select that doesn't just take in t, r, but t, int, r, which contains the index in the sequence. How do you implement that guy? Well, if you have SIP, and I leave it in the middle how you implement SIP in this world, but if you have SIP and you have some ANA thing to create an infinite sequence of numbers, you can basically SIP the enumerable of T source with the natural numbers, which are 0, 1, 2, all the way to infinity. And then you have a T and an int and some sequence that you can feed into the selector. So you can again build things on top of that one. So that's basically it. That's the way things are layered in this world.
That's great, but now I want to get a little bit more explicit and concrete.
Yep. Yep.
And I want you to list out for us, I mean, even though you've said it, just so we have a nice concrete conclusion.
Yep.
What are, you know, you told us we were going to bring this down to 3.
Yep.
Okay. And you showed us this nice graph with Anna, with folding, unfolding,
yes,
and the monad.
Yep.
And select many and bind. So there's bind, right?
Yep.
This is
yes,
bind.
Exactly. That's bind. Yep.
So we're talking about bind. So essentially, this is interesting because we can bring this back to the shape, wrap, and roll concept of what a monad is.
Yes. Yep.
But and that's for people out there that are also watching the Greg Meredith lectures. I'm sure
exactly.
you are as well.
Yes. Yeah.
So. I just wanted to kind of bring everything together. So in 20 seconds, synthesize what we just went through as a conclusion.
Yes.
And we're going to get you, you're going to do some lectures in FY11, I hope.
Okay.
We need to get you lecturing.
I'm into that. Yep.
And then we need to go talk to Wes today.
Exactly. So
there's some RX stuff going on.
So conclusion. Well, we minimized link based on the types by actually getting rid of interfaces and going all the way back to function signatures.
Nice.
Which just really shows the way that the duality works, just by looking and reversing the arrows. And we reduced the operators based on the layer diagram, where we said, like, the base operators are a way to get into the world, which I call Anna, or unfold.
Okay.
A way to get out, which is default, you know, turning everything, compressing matter together. And then a way to do composition, which is the bind. So instead of 50 operators, we have 3 core ones on which we can implement all of the other ones. I'm not saying all of the other ones, because there are some extreme ones.
Okay.
Especially if you look at Rx, where you have the whole time notion, you would have to add the notion of an iScheduler as well. And I invite people to minimize iScheduler to a single function as well.
Cool.
And if you do that, well, you end up with minimized Rx.
Nice.
Yep.
Excellent, man. And
yes,
I won't add any code. When you were speaking, the one thing that came to my mind was the notion of monad, and of course it's dual, co-monad, and then the way that you compose you know, either monadic composition with monads or inside with functions or both.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So, all right, I think everyone who's watching this, our minds are bending, man. But okay. It's so cool to learn.
Well, you know, people said, like, if you go to the four-dimensional space, you have curvature.
Nice.
In physics, so, you know.
Yes.
The minds need to be a little bit bent from this.
Absolutely. Now, mm-hmm. Let's keep bending minds, man.
Yes, we'll do so.
Great
definitely.
Work. Great to talk to you again, yep. Bart.
Thank you.
Very educational, man.